Good afternoon. This is Read Me Something You Love. And this afternoon I am sitting in the free word setter. I've been here a number of times. It's almost becoming a kind of sort of Groundhog Day, I feel. I'm sort of mining the seam of free wordedness because they've been very kind. And whenever I say, or rather whenever you say, because you book these rooms, can Steve come along and record us reading a story? They always seem to say yes.
They do. They're very accommodating, and it's a nice space to read in, despite potential traffic noise. Mm.
Yes, so we've got a little bit of traffic, and before we actually had more than just a murmuring of voices. We had a whole brouhaha of voices out in the corridor, which we had decided were going to be quite atmospheric for the story that is going to be read today. But the voices have gone, but they might return. So we're prepared. And we are today, me and Rosalind Harvey, who is a translator. And
I suppose I now have to describe myself as an events curator or some such horrible
that
title.
That sounds good.
Yeah, so I was translator in residence here at the Free Word Centre for 3 months last autumn, along with Nikki Harmon, who's also read you something she loves. And ever since then, I've been thrown into the world of doing events, but all based around something to do with translation. So I also do a bit of Spanish tutoring on the side and a few other bits and bobs. But translation is my main raison d'etre, I suppose.
And Rosalind may be known to you as the translator of Down the Rabbit Hole by
the Mexican author Juan Pablo Villalobos.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that and not me.
He has a tricky name. Yeah.
I was quite surprised when you said to me you were going to read... I don't know why I was surprised when you said to me you were going to read Mavis Gallant. I thought you were... I don't know. I assumed you as a translator were going to sort of come up with something translated, like Calvino or, Marquez or something along those lines. So why Mavis Gallant?
There's something about her which has to do with existing between two places or two spaces, which you could argue is a lot of what translation is about. So, French-Canadian, she was born in Canada but moved to Paris, and I think her childhood was in French and English, so she's very aware of the way that language can give you two different places to exist in. And her stories, as we were saying earlier, they're very slippery, they're very hard to pin down. The characters are often quite ambiguous, but also quite ambivalent in their own views about what they're doing, what they believe in, the relationships that they have. And it's something about that ambiguity and that slipperiness that I really love about her stories. They're really hard to describe. It's really hard to... I mean, not that anything much even happens in a lot of them, but when it does, it's very hard to pin down what exactly it is. And yeah, the language issues are interesting. There is French in a lot of her stories, but there's just more a general sense, I think, of the way that language can be very mysterious and very potent at the same time, which as a translator, obviously, I'm really interested in. The language is so beautiful. It's it's extremely precise, but it's very slippery at the same time. And then the ending is so cryptic. I think it does take several readings, and maybe it's impossible to pin it down, and maybe that's why it's so attractive. I still find it frustrating. I mean, I don't think I've picked it apart completely, but I think that's partly why I like it, because it's unknowable.
Yeah. I think it also needs... I suppose we shouldn't try and talk it up too much. We should actually read the bloody thing. But I think it also needs... I don't know how you feel, but I feel it needs quite a slow... rendition.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because the sentences have got such a lot going on in them, and yet at the same way they're quite flat. I was wondering earlier on when I read it again here coming on the tube, I sort of thought, do I have some sort of attention deficit disorder issue going on? Because I was finding it really difficult to actually stay with the story, even though enjoying each sentence, when I came back to it, enjoying it immensely.
Yeah, I think a slow reading would be the best way to approach it. Voices lost in snow. Halfway between our two great wars, parents whose own early years had been shaped with Edwardian firmness were apt to lend a tone of finality to quite simple remarks. "Because I say so" was the answer to "why?" And a child's response to "what did I just tell you?" could seldom be anything but "not to." Not to say, do, touch, remove, go out, argue, reject, eat, pick up, open, shout, appear to sulk, appear to be cross. Dark riddles filled the corners of life because no enlightenment was thought required. Asking questions was being tiresome, while persistent curiosity got one nowhere, at least nowhere of interest. How much has changed? Observe the drift of words descending from adult to child, the fall of personal questions, observations, unnecessary instructions. Before long, the listener seems blanketed. He must hear the voice as authority muffled, a hum through snow. The tone has changed. It may be coaxing, even plaintive, but the words have barely altered. They still claim the ancient right of way through a young life. "Well, old cock," said my father's friend Archie McEwen, meeting him one Saturday in Montreal. "How's Charlotte taking life in the country?" Apparently, no one had expected my mother to accept the country in winter. "Well, old cock," I repeated to a country neighbour, Mr. Bainwood, "how's life?" What do you suppose it meant to me, other than a kind of weather vane? Mr. Bainwood thought it over, then came round to our house and complained to my mother. "It isn't blasphemy," she said, not letting him have much satisfaction from the complaint. Still, I had to apologise. "I'm sorry" was a ritual habit with even less meaning than "old cock." "Never say that again," my mother said after he had gone. "Why not?" "Because I've just told you not to." "What does it mean?" "Nothing." It must have been after yet another nothing that one summer's day I ran screaming around a garden, tore the heads off tulips, and... No, let another voice finish it. The only authentic voices I have belong to the dead. Then she ate them. It was my father's custom, if he took me with him to visit a friend on Saturdays, not to say where we were going. He was more taciturn than any man I have known since, but that wasn't all of it. Being young, I was the last person to whom anyone owed an explanation. These Saturdays have turned into one whitish afternoon, a windless snowfall, a steep street. Two persons descend the street, stepping carefully. The child, reminded every day to keep her hands still, gesticulates wildly. There is the flash of a red mitten. I will never overtake this pair. Their voices are lost in snow. We were living in what used to be called the country and is now a suburb of Montreal. On Saturdays, my father and I came in together by train. I went to the doctor, the dentist, to my German lesson. After that, I had to get back to Windsor Station by myself and on time. My father gave me a boy's watch so that the dial would be good and large. I remember the number 83 streetcar trundling downhill and myself wondering if the watch was slow, asking strangers to tell me the hour. Inevitably, how could it have been otherwise? After his death, which would not be long in coming, I would dream that someone important had taken a train without me. My route to the meeting place, deviated, betrayed by stopped clocks, was always downhill. As soon as I was old enough to understand from my reading of myths and legends that this journey was a pursuit of darkness, its terminal point a sunless underworld, The dream vanished.
Thank you. So, perhaps we could start with some of the places where I start to lose my footing. Where I go, like, whoa, what's going on here? So, for example, in the, I mean, you know, the first paragraph, where I start to slip a bit is when we get to this line about the voices. Observe the drift of words descending from adult to child, fall of personal questions, observations, unnecessary instructions. Before long, the listener seems blanketed. He must hear the voice as authority, muffled, a hum through snow. So is this about memory? Is this about not being able to... Why the muffledness? Is it not being able to dredge up those voices, even though they were quite cutting and acute and even hurtful?
I think this part is actually the narrator, and so potentially Mavis herself, because this is supposed to be one of the more autobiographical stories.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Observing that the way that she remembers adults talking to her as a child hasn't really changed, and children are still talked down to and told to be quiet, fobbed off with because I say so's and other things that people always say to kids. She says, yeah, the tone has changed, but the words have barely altered. And it feels like this, I think this first paragraph, she's setting out the point of the story, or one of the points of the story, which is that this approach that adults have of talking to children, the way that they treat children, is something that affected her as a child and is a very negative way of being with your children, and it still exists.
Yeah.
So she says they still claim the ancient right of way through a young life. Her father and her mother didn't give her any explanation for why she should or shouldn't behave in a certain way, and so she learned to just to shut up, to stop doing things, but also that certain words had a real power, although she didn't understand why, so they became mysterious. And she doesn't agree with this.
Yes, I mean, it's a very sort of pregnant phrase, isn't it? The ancient rite of way through a young life. It's almost as if the child is a sort of there's something wild, you know, the beast in the nursery, something wild actually about children. And, you know, partly what adults do is kind of civilize them, and to civilize them they have to actually commit some sort of violence on them. They have to kind of hack through this
undergrowth. Yeah, creates a bridle path.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet the child can't be contained.
Well, she's a nuisance to them. You know, maybe she was a mistake, but you get a real sense, in the next section at least, of how young her mother was.
Yes.
And how isolated she felt. You know, she tries to lose herself in novels, and she doesn't really want to be a mother or a wife.
Yeah.
And her father doesn't really want to be a father. So long as Lynette keeps quiet and doesn't make a mess, then her presence is tolerated, but she's definitely not, you know, the light of their lives in any way.
Well, let's read a bit more then, shall we?
Sometimes I would be taken along to lunch with one or another of my father's friends. He would meet the friend at Pausée's for oysters, or at Drury's, or the Windsor Grill. The friend would, more often than not, be Scottish or English sounding, and they would talk as if I were invisible, as Archie McEwen had done, and eat what I thought of as English food, grilled kidneys, sweetbreads, which I was too finicky to touch. Both my parents had been made wretched as children by having food forced on them, and so that particular torture was never inflicted on me. However, the manner in which I ate was subject to precise attention. My father disapproved of the North American custom that he called spearing, knife laid on the plate, fork in the right hand. My mother's eye was out for a straight back, invisible chewing, small mouthfuls, immobile silence during the interminable adult loafing over dessert. My mother did not care for food. If we were alone together, she would sit smoking and reading, sipping black coffee, her elbows used as props, a posture that would have called for instant banishment had I so much as tried it. Being constantly observed and corrected was like having a fly buzzing around one's plate. At Posé's, the only child, perhaps the only female, I sat up to an oak counter and ate oysters quite neatly, not knowing exactly what they were, and certainly not that they were alive. They were served as in The Walrus and the Carpenter, with bread and butter, pepper and vinegar. Dessert was a chocolate biscuit. Plates of them stood at intervals along the counter. When my father and I ate alone, I was not required to say much, nor could I expect a great deal in the way of response. After I had been addressing him for minutes, sometimes he would suddenly come to life, and I would know he had been elsewhere. "Of course I've been listening," he would protest, and he would repeat by way of proof the last few words of whatever it was I'd been saying. He was seldom present. I don't know where my father spent his waking life, just elsewhere. What was he doing alone with a child? Where was his wife? In the country, reading. She read one book after another without looking up, without scraping away the frost on the windows. "The Russians, you know, the Russians," she said to her mother and me, glancing around in the drugged way adolescent readers have. "They put salt on the window sills in winter." Yes, so they did, in the 19th century, in the boyhood of Turgenev, of Tolstoy. The salt absorbed the moisture between two sets of windows, sealed shut for half the year. She must have been in a Russian country house at that moment, surrounded by a large Russian family, living out vast Russian complications. The flat white fields beyond her imaginary windows were like the flat white fields she would have observed if only she had looked out. She was myopic. The pupil, when she had been reading, seemed to be the whole of the eye. What age was she then? 27, 28. Her husband had removed her to the country. Now that they were there, he seldom spoke. How young she seems to me now. Half 28 in perception and feeling, but with a husband, a child, a house, a life, an illiterate maid from the village whose life she confidently interfered with and mismanaged, a small zoo of animals she alternately cherished and forgot. And she was the daughter of such a sensible, truthful, pessimistic woman. Pessimistic in the way women become when they settle for what actually exists. Our rooms were not Russian. They were aired every day, and the salt became a great nuisance, blowing in on the floor. "There, Charlotte, what did I tell you?" my grandmother said. This grandmother did not care for dreams or for children. If I sensed the first, I had no hint of the latter. Out of decency, she kept it quiet, at least in a child's presence. She had the reputation, shared with a long-vanished nurse named Olivia, of being able to do anything with me, which merely meant an ability to provoke from a child behaviour convenient for adults. It was she who taught me to eat in the continental way, with both hands in sight at all times upon the table, and who made me sit at meals with books under my arms so I would learn not to stick out my elbows. I remember having accepted this nonsense from her without a trace of resentment. Like Olivia, she could make the most pointless sort of training seem a natural way of life. I think that, as discipline goes, this must be the most dangerous form of all. She was one of three godparents I had, the most important one. It is impossible for me to enter the mind of this agnostic who taught me prayers, who had already shed every remnant of belief when she committed me at the font. I know that she married late and reluctantly, She would have preferred a life of solitude and independence, next to impossible for a woman in her time. She had the positive voice of the born teacher, sharp manners, quick blue eyes, and the square, massive figure common to both lines of her ancestry, the west of France, the north of Germany. When she said, "There, Charlotte, what did I tell you?" without obtaining an answer, it summed up mother and daughter both. My father's friend, Malcolm Whitmore, was the second godparent. He quarrelled with my mother when she said something flippant about Mussolini, disappeared, died in Europe some years later, though perhaps not fighting for Franco, as my mother had it. She often rewrote other people's lives, providing them with suitable and harmonious endings. In her version of events, you were supposed to die as you'd lived. He would write sometimes, asking me, "Have you been confirmed yet?" He had never really held a place and could not, by dying, leave a gap. The third godparent was a young woman named Georgie Henderson. She was my mother's choice, for a long time her confidant, partisan, and close sympathiser. Something happened and they stopped seeing each other. Georgie was not her real name. It was Edna May. One of the reasons she had fallen out with my mother was that I had not been called Edna May too. Apparently, this had been promised. You were laughing a lot during that section.
Well, yeah, I mean...
It is funny, isn't it?
It is. I'm actually quite surprised at just how... I sort of almost want to sort of cackle with glee at every sentence in a way.
Yeah, well, it seems like such a stiff and starchy existence. I mean, maybe it's just nervous giggles that it's producing because you really get a sense of how people must have had to hold themselves all the time in this kind of environment. But it's amazing the way she achieves that, because she is essentially just describing her upbringing and the rules and regulations that shaped her existence, but the way she does it gives you such a sense of how nonsensical they all were. So it's subversive, but it's hard to put your finger on why. Yes. Why it creates that effect.
Yes, because essentially she's saying, you know, this is how it was. I had a horribly distracted father who hardly gave me the time of day. I had a depressed mother who also, for maybe different reasons, hardly gave me the time of day. And yet it's not self-pitying.
No, it's quite a hard tone in many ways. It feels quite distant. You can sense that the narrator is very far removed from her childhood.
Yeah.
And is looking back on this little girl that she was with pity in a way, but it's not really self-pitying. She's sort of bemused and amused as well at how this little girl got through this childhood,
yeah,
accepting these rules.
I think it's that distancing that maybe has made Galad quite difficult for me to read, and maybe possibly makes her the so-called writer's writer to a certain extent, because it does feel like this is how somebody would talk about their childhood if they'd, you know, after years and years of psychoanalysis, in a way. They'd supposedly worked it all out in a very kind of theoretical, join all the dots together kind of way. But so much so that they almost weren't in touch with the feelings there anymore.
She's analysed her childhood and what happened to her, but hasn't necessarily got in touch with and dealt with the emotions that were so overpowering at the time. But then she seems like quite a happy child at the same time, as it's very repressed. She seems...
Yes. What gives you the sense that she's happy?
Well,
I get the sense of actually quite a fairly miserable child, constantly trying to, you know, looking for attention and not getting the kind of attention she needs, having to sort of go off on one and behead a few tulips.
No,
in
it's
order
true.
To...
I mean, yeah, she's clearly been a bit messed up by her parents. But she seems quite tough. because of this, because no one else is going to help her. She's got no clues from her parents or from the language they use with her. And she's figured stuff out for herself.
And there is you know, there is a little bit of hope, or I read this as hopeful, the fact that the parents having been made wretched as children by having food forced on them, and so that that particular torture was never inflicted on me. There is the sense, you know, Larkin in the This Be the Verse, he says, you know, man hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. And actually there's a sense here that, yes, you know, the mother's had the misery handed on from her mother, and now she's handing down the misery. But it's slightly alleviated because the mother and the father have realised there's certain miseries that they endured, which actually they're mindful of the fact that they don't want their child to suffer that.
Yeah, and I'm sure in other, you know, in previous times, and maybe with other families, you wouldn't find a father taking his daughter out to eat oysters because his wife was incapable. She might be foisted on another female relative. You know, she's not allowed to say much, but she is allowed to just sit there and jabber on, regardless of the fact that he's, you know, he's looking into the middle distance. He's not really listening, but she's there with her father.
He is comforting in a way, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a solid presence, even if he's not an entirely present presence. Yeah.
And I suppose I hadn't actually thought about that. He, by taking her out to eat oysters, he is treating her more like an adult in a way. He is actually
he is
giving her an equality which the mother doesn't do.
There's no children's menu available.
No.
And she doesn't know what they are. They're probably one of the most adult things you could eat.
Yes.
She's not questioning them. She's quite happy to sit there with him.
Yeah,
be another of his friends almost.
I love the description of how, and that perhaps because I could really identify with it, the mother sort of has thrown her depressive self into the Russians and you know, reading these long, long books. And it just, when you were reading it, I sort of remembered a particular period in my life where I was pretty downcast, and I remember a period where I worked my way through all the John Updike, you know, the Rabbit.
Oh, yeah.
All of those. And I just lived in... wherever it's set. Where is it? Pennsylvania or something?
Somewhere like that.
I just lived in Pennsylvania for about 3 weeks, and it was great.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that? Sort of.
I think I spent almost most of my life doing it.
Deliberately kind of said, and it was almost a conscious thing. I sort of said, right, I'm going to go and live in Pennsylvania now. I don't want any of this other stuff. I'm going to go there.
That's what makes good literature so appealing, is that it's a place you can truly go and live there for a while.
Are you still able to do that? Because I find that harder and harder to do, to escape into a book.
Yeah, I go through cycles, I think. I had a period about a year ago when I found it very difficult to read anything at all, especially in Spanish, because I would associate it with trying to find something new to translate. But even in English, because I was just reading so much. And anything I read, I was sort of subconsciously taking notes on it, trying to figure out things about the plot and the style and the characterization and the voice. And I couldn't stop myself doing it. And I stopped reading, and I didn't read anything for, it was over a month. I mean, I was reading little articles and things that you have to read for work, but I didn't read a novel or any short stories for, maybe it was closer to 2 months. And like the way I eased myself back into it was by reading, I think it was a Ruth Rendell detective novel. And I love detective novels anyway, but I think I need to take regular breaks from reading. Otherwise, you know, you can overdo it. It can be total escapism or not. And it once it gets to the point where it feels too much like work, then you have to have a rest.
Well, let's return. We're just about to launch into talking about the third godparent, isn't it? Georgie.
Georgie, yeah. Yes. Georgie Henderson. Without saying where we were going, my father took me along to visit Georgie one Saturday afternoon. "You didn't say you were bringing Linnet," was how she greeted him. We stood in the passage of a long, hot, high-ceilinged apartment, treading snow water into the rug. He said, "Well, she is your godchild, and she has been ill." My godmother shut the front door and leaned her back against it. It is in this surprisingly dramatic pose that I recall her. It would be unfair to repeat what I think I saw then, for she and I were to meet again once, only once, many years after this, and I might substitute a lined face for a smooth one, and tough, large-knuckled hands for fingers that may have been delicate. One has to allow elbow room in the account of arrival. She must have had something, is how it generally goes, long after the initial, "What can he see in her? He must be deaf and blind." Georgie, explained by my mother as being the natural daughter of Sarah Bernhardt and a stork, is only a shadow, a tracing, with long arms and legs, and one of those slightly puggy faces with pulled-up eyes. Her voice remains, the husky Virginia Tobacco whisper I associate with so many women of that generation, my parents' friends. It must have come of age in English Montreal around 1920, when girls began to cut their hair and to smoke. In middle life, the voice would slide from low to harsh and develop a chronic cough. For the moment, it was fascinating to me. Opposite in pitch and speed from my mother's, which was slightly too high and apt to break off, like that of a singer unable to sustain a long note. It was true that I had been ill, but I don't think my godmother made much of it that afternoon, other than saying, "It's all very well to talk about that now, but I was certainly never told much. And as for that doctor, you ought to just hear what Ward thinks." Out of this whispered jumble, my mother stood accused of many transgressions, certainly, but chiefly of having discarded Dr. Ward Mackey, everyone's doctor and a family friend. At the time of my birth, my mother had all at once decided she liked Ward Mackey better than anyone else, and had asked him to choose a name for me. He could not think of one, or rather thought of too many, and finally consulted his own mother. She had always longed for a daughter, so that she could call her after the heroine of a novel by, I believe, Marie Corelli. The legend so often repeated to me goes on to tell that when I was 7 weeks old, my father suddenly asked, "What did you say her name was?" "Votre fille a frôlé la phtisie," the new doctor had said, the one who had now replaced Dr. Mackey. The new doctor was known to me as Uncle Raoul, though we were not related. This manner of declaring my brush with consumption was worlds away from Ward Mackey's subject to bilious attacks. Mackey's objections to Uncle Raoul were neither envious nor personal, for Mackey was the sort of bachelor who could console himself with golf. The Protestant in him truly believed those other doctors to be poorly trained and superstitious, capable of recommending the pulling of teeth to cure tonsillitis, and of letting their patients cough to death or perish from septicemia just through Catholic fatalism. What parent could fail to grasp and marvel at Uncle Raoul's announcement? Any but either of mine. My mother could invent and produce better dramas any day. As for my father, his French wasn't all that good, and he had to have it explained. Once he understood that I had grazed the edge of tuberculosis, he made his decision to remove us all to the country, which he had been wanting a reason to do for some time. He was, I think, attempting to isolate his wife, but by taking her out of the city, he exposed her to a danger that, being English, he had never dreamed of. This was the heart-stopping cry of the steam train at night, sweeping across a frozen river, clattering on the ties of a wooden bridge. From our separate rooms, my mother and I heard the unrivaled summons, the long, urgent, uniquely North American beckoning. She would follow, and so would I, but separately, years and desires and destinations apart. I think that women once pledged in such a manner are more steadfast than men. Frôlée was the charmed word in that winter's story. It was a hand brushing the edge of folded silk, a leaf escaping a spider web. Being caught in the web would have meant staying in bed day and night in a place even worse than a convent school. Charlotte and Angus, whose lives had once seemed so enchanted, so fortunate and free that I could not imagine lesser persons so much as eating the same kind of toast for breakfast, had to share their lives with me, whether they wanted to or not. Thanks to Uncle Raoul, who always supposed me to be their principal delight. I had been standing on one foot for months now, midway between frôler and falling into, propped up by a psychosomatic guardian angel. Of course, I could not stand that way forever. Inevitably, my health improved, and before long, I was declared out of danger and then restored, to the relief and pleasure of all except the patient. "I'd like to see more of you than eyes and nose," said my godmother. "Take off your things." I offer this as an example of unnecessary instruction. Would anyone over the age of 3 prepare to spend the afternoon in a stifling room wrapped like a mummy in outdoor clothes? "She's smaller than she looks," Georgie remarked as I began to emerge. This authentic godmother observation drives me to my only refuge, the insistence that she must have had something. He could not have been completely deaf and blind. Divested of hat, scarf, coat, overshoes, and leggings, grasping the handkerchief pressed in my hand so I would not interrupt later by asking for one, responding to my father's muttered, "Fix your hair," struck by the command because it was he who had told me not to use "fix" in that sense, I was finally able to sit down next to him on a white sofa. My godmother occupied its twin. A low table stood between, bearing a decanter and glasses, and a pile of magazines, and, of course, Georgie's ashtrays. I think she smoked even more than my mother did. On one of these sofas, during an earlier visit with my mother and father, the backs of my dangling feet had left a smudge of shoe polish. It may have been the last occasion when my mother and Georgie were ever together. Directed to stop humming and kicking, and perhaps bored with the conversation in which I was not expected to join, I had soon started up again. "It doesn't matter," my godmother said, though you could tell she minded. "Sit up," my father said to me. "I am sitting up. What do you think I'm doing?" This was not answering, but answering back. It is not an expression I ever heard from my father, but I am certain it stood like a stalled truck in Georgie's mind. She wore the look people put on when they are thinking, "Now what are you spineless parents going to do about that?" "Oh, for God's sake, she's only a child," said my mother, as though that had ever been an excuse for anything. Soon after the sofa-kicking incident, she and Georgie moved into the hibernation known as not speaking. This, the lingering condition of half my mother's friendships, usually followed her having said the very thing no one wanted to hear, such as, "Who wants to be called Edna May anyway?" Once more in the hot, pale room, where there was nothing to do and nothing for children, I offended my godmother again by pretending I had never seen her before. The spot I had kicked was pointed out to me, though, owing to new slip covers, real evidence was missing. My father was proud of my quite surprising memory, of its long backward reach and the minutiae of detail I could describe. My failure now to shine in a domain where I was naturally gifted, that did not require lessons or create litter and noise, must have annoyed him. I also see that my guileless-seeming needling of my godmother was a close adaptation of how my mother could be, and I attribute it to a child's instinctive loyalty to the absent one. Giving me up, my godmother placed a silver dish of mint wafers where I could reach them, white, pink, and green, overlapping, and suggested I look at a magazine. Whatever the magazine was, I had probably seen it, for my mother subscribed to everything then. I may have turned the pages anyway, in case at home something had been censored for children. I felt, and am certain I have not invented, Georgie's disappointment at not seeing Angus alone. She disliked Charlotte now, and so I supposed he came to call by himself, having no quarrel of his own. He was still close to the slighted Ward Mackey. My father and Georgie talked for a while, she using people's initials instead of their names, which my mother would not have done. And they drank what must have been sherry, if I think of the shape of the decanter. Then we left and went down to the street in a wood-panelled elevator that had sconce lights, as in a room. The end of the afternoon had a particular shade of colour then, which is not tinted by distance or enhancement, but has to do with how streets were lighted. Lamps were still gas, and their soft, gradual blooming at dusk made the sky turn a peacock blue that slowly deepened to marine, then indigo. This uneven light, falling in blurred pools, gave the snow it touched a quality of phosphorescence, beyond which were night shadows in which no one lurked. There were few cars, little sound. A fresh snowfall would lie in the streets in a way that seemed natural. Sidewalks were dangerous, casually sanded. Even on busy streets you found traces of the icy slides children's feet had made. The reddish brown of the stone houses, the curve and slope of the streets, the constantly changing sky were satisfactory in a way that I now realise must have been aesthetically comfortable. This is what I saw when I read City in a book. I had no means of knowing that city, one day, would also mean drab, filthy, flat, or that city blocks could turn into dull squares without mystery. We crossed Sherbrooke Street, staring down to catch our train. My father walked everywhere in all weathers. Already mined, colonised by an enemy prepared to destroy what it fed on, fighting it with every wrong weapon, squandering strength he should have been storing, stifling pain in silence rather than speaking up while there might have been time. He gave an impression of sternness that was a shield against suffering. One day we heard a mob roaring four syllables over and over, and we turned and went down a different street. That sound was starkly terrifying, something a child might liken to the baying of wolves. What is it? Howie Morentz. Who is it? Are they chasing him? No, they like him, he said, of the hockey player admired to the point of dementia. He seemed to stretch as if trying to keep every bone in his body from touching a nerve. A look of helplessness, such as I had never seen on a grown person, gripped his face, and he said this strange thing. Crowds eat me. Noise eats me. The kind of physical pain that makes one seem rat's prey is summed up in my memory of this. When we came abreast of the Ritz-Carlton after leaving Georgie's apartment, my father paused. The lights within at that time of day were golden and warm. If I barely knew what hotel meant, never having stayed in one, I connected the lights with other snowy afternoons, with stupefying adult conversations. Oh, those shut-in, velvet-draped, unaired, low-voice problems. Compensated for by creamy, bitter hot chocolate poured out of a pink and white china pot. You missed your goûte, he suddenly remembered. Established by my grandmother, goûte was the family word for tea. He often transformed French words, like putty, into shapes he could grasp. No, Georgie had not provided a goûte, other than the mint wafers, but it was not her fault. I had not been announced. Perhaps if I had not been so disagreeable with her, he might have proposed hot chocolate now, though I knew better than to ask. He merely pulled my scarf up over my nose and mouth, as if recalling something Uncle Raoul had advised. Breathing inside knitted wool was delicious, warm, moist, pungent when one had been sucking on mint candies, as now. He said, "You didn't enjoy your visit much." "Not very," through red wool. "No matter," he said. "You needn't see Georgie again, unless you want to." And we walked on. He must have been smarting, for he liked me to be admired. When I was not being admired, I was supposed to keep quiet. "You needn't see Georgie again" was also a private decision about himself. He was barely 31 and had a full winter to live after this one, little more. Why? Because I say so. The answer seems to speak out of the lights, the stones, the snow, out of the crucial second when inner and outer forces join, and the environment becomes part of the enemy too. Ward Mackey used to mention me as Angus's precocious pain in the neck, which is better than nothing. Long after that afternoon, when I was about 20, Mackey said to me, "Georgie didn't play her cards well where he was concerned. There was a point where, if she had just made one smart move, she could have had him. Not for long, of course, but none of us knew that." What cards, I wonder? The cards have another meaning for me. They mean a trip, a death, a letter, tomorrow, next year. I saw only one move that Saturday. My father placed a card face up on the table and watched to see what Georgie made of it. She shrugged, let it rest. There she sits, looking puggy but capable, Angus waiting, the precocious pain in the neck turning pages, hoping to find something in the National Geographic harmful for children. I brush in memory against the spider web. What if she had picked it up, remarking in her smoky voice, "Yes, I can use that." It was a low card, the kind that only a born gambler would risk as part of a long-term strategy. She would never have weakened a hand that way. She was not gambling, but building. He took the card back and dropped his hand, and their long, intermittent game came to an end. The card must have been the Eight of Clubs. A female child.
Thank you. And so the long, although it is only 10 pages, but it feels quite long, doesn't it?
It does.
The long intermittent story comes to an end.
Yeah. Yeah, it does feel quite long.
What a strange end. Yeah.
I think it partly feels long because we move back and forth in time. So you get a sort of stretching out sense when she pulls back into the body of the narrator, as it were, and then you get sort of shunted back into the present of the story when she's a child, and it's quite tiring, actually. There's something in there about her use of her own childhood memories to construct something as a narrator, and the way that language works as well in the story, I keep coming back to. So she's told no because I said so. She's told not to say old cock, but she's told that it means nothing. And that idea that language has this sort of meaningless but incantatory property for this child. She's told you can't say that, but she's not told why. So there's a conflict.
It's all these mixed messages.
Mixed messages. Something's being banned, but I've been told it means nothing, which must be incredibly confusing. And I think it would mean that you would invest language with all sorts of strange properties that it does have anyway, but it becomes a code and a mystery and something that's obviously connected to power in some way. There's the language side, and then that moving in and out of one period in the story when she's little Linnet Muir, and then when she's the observing older Linnet Muir. But it's slippery. It's hard to pin down. I think that there's something here in her relationship with her father. He's going to meet this woman on his own, essentially. Well, he's not on his own. He has Lynette, but he's without his wife. So the question of his wife's friendship with this woman is nothing to do with shoe polish on the sofa or with the name Edna May. It's because she is or was a lover or a potential lover of the father. And this is his final visit to her, and he's making her an offer, or he's putting his cards on the table. And she is a card. Lynette Muir is a card. He's saying, we could potentially have a future together, but I have a daughter. Is this something that you would be interested in sharing with me? And there's a rejection. He takes the card back. And the card must have been the Eight of Clubs, a female child. So I think he puts her on the table.